But no, I know nothing about that. I assume that there was some decision made, but can't say that.
Yeah, probably. There was a two-volume history of French forestry in the 16th century published by a student of Rodel's a few years back. And there, it seems that in the 16th century, there was a serious problem with raising certain kinds of timber. And then, of course, you'd also have to have naval stores of various kinds. And the question, of course, is where they got that for all of these 80 ships.
I have a question for Professor Ainge. You talked about the rather ambivalent views of the English towards the Huguenots. On the one hand, is kind of hero, on the other hand, kind of pious to obstructionists or whatever. What is the impact of that? Is it obvious and simply an analogy, or what would be the impact of the view of the Huguenots on the whole problem of Puritanism in the Anglican Church? Is there a direct association of Huguenots and Puritan in the English mind, or are they seen as a different problem entirely? It seems to be the same characteristics as English Puritan.
Yeah, from what I found, the English writers that I would consider Puritans during the second half of the 16th century just loved the Puritan Huguenots and thought that these were God's chosen people, etc., etc. English non-Puritans, as I say, tended to get very irritated with them. And I did not run across any comments on their part that, you know, these people are just as foolish as the English Puritans. They didn't seem to make that connection, or if they did, they didn't write about it. My research, I must say, stopped in 1600, and you might have had more of this in the 17th century. I don't know. I rather suspect you would.
When my promoter started to pull the teeth approach to Puritanism in England, part of the English having seen the difficulties in
learning. Well, the lesson was certainly there to learn.
This is related to that question. Like, was the view of the hero more as the warrior hero, particularly among the Puritans, or the martyr hero?
You got both. I think the martyr was the more popular image. One of the chief English works on the wars of a long history by this fellow Anthony Collinet that I quoted did see them, however, as primarily as warriors. They were God's fighters. Whenever they lost a battle, it was just, you know, this battle was only over a bunch of farm boys. It wasn't over the real army, or the Catholics cheated. There was some explanation, because God would not let his side lose if he really was on the ball that day.
Mr. Davis, I'm curious if you find this image of Huguenot that you've been referring to influencing, for example, Shakespeare's characterization of the French in the history plays.
No.
I think that is more drawing on the traditional chronicle material.
Shakespeare, it seemed to me, was the last traditionalist. In the 1590s particularly, I noted just about every other author was really toning down criticism of France. You know, Stowe's Chronicle is not nearly as hostile as either Hall or Hollis said. Other writers are very nice to the French. And Shakespeare is like a throwback to the time of Henry VIII. He's absolutely vicious towards the French. And I think perhaps the only other incidents of such viciousness I could find were the treatment of French people by the London crowds, the London mob. Maybe Shakespeare was just kind of throwing us off to the groundlings in the audience by presenting his Frenchmen as such despicable characters.
Did that have really congruous with his showing he's a money-making playwright and appealing to the popular audience? What was running through my head listening to you was that we've seen that Shakespeare would capitalize things just didn't represent as popular dramatists. Want to capitalize on this growing sentiment, and obviously he doesn't. Obviously, he is quite contrary.
It would be interesting if he had written a play on the wars of religion. You know, what kind of an image you would have had there. But I would think, you know, I talk about the decrease in hostility towards the French. But I would think that presenting the French as cowards even in the 1590s would not turn off an audience. I just think that most of them would probably take it with a grain of salt.
I'm intrigued by the pamphlet. You know, to what extent do you say that they represent a sort of official view? Or, in other words, what is the official attitude towards them?
Neither Protestant pamphlets nor Politique pamphlets had any trouble getting licenses, as far as I can tell. The Catholic oriented pamphlets could not, of course, attain any official sanction. Other than that, the only case where I ran into a pamphlet on the wars receiving any kind of trouble from the government or any kind of either acceptance or attack was a pamphlet on Catherine de' Medici, which Elizabeth apparently thought was too vicious, and she did not want queens looked at in that bad a light, by her subjects, and this had to be clandestinely printed, even though it was Protestant. Other than that, as far as I could tell, the government just ignored these things and didn't.
So even at the time of the so-called French wooing, the very time the printers didn't get into trouble with pretty pamphlets.
No. John Stubbs did, of course, when he wrote his pamphlet, he chopped his hand off. Other than that, one printer in particular, John Wolfe, was responsible for most of the pamphlets, and apparently was a thriving businessman, had five presses, was one of the biggest in London. I guess did quite well out of it.
Did he get any representation?
I don't know. I really don't. I'm sorry. That would be interesting to see.
You mentioned
that
the there were some views, English views, that the French wars of religion is part of a struggle, or at least as a struggle between the forces of God and the forces of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
How widespread was this, and was this ever carried in further to be more apocalyptic, or at least the general theme of history?
As to how widespread it was, I came across it in four or five works of a very puritanical nature. Now, how much opinion this represents is something that I just would not feel qualified to speculate on. But it was not just one or two people. That's any comfort. I never did see it tied into a larger, theological scheme of history as a whole, I must say. The chroniclers who were writing world history did not go into this sort of thing.
Why is that
a
footnote? Came across this question, visitation at NYU several years ago by a fellow named Lynch, R-N-C-H, who studies the history plays of the late 16th or 17th century, particularly the Protestant Catholic tendency. He developed that whole idea of the psychomachia, forces of good and evil, aligned between Protestant Catholic, and it takes some hints from the rhythm. I don't know if a lot of history plays that take that approach for you.
Mr. Spallenberg, is there any evidence that Henry might have attempted to use his navy to conquer territory in America, or to colonize America, I should say, Spanish in America?
Let's see, I missed the last part. Was to conquer territory in America, or
to colonize territory, or to challenge the Spanish?
Well, Elaine Fowler is pretty critical of Henry in her Folger published, the little pamphlets she did sponsored by the Folger. She criticizes Henry for being too much of this, dressing up in a cloth of gold and velvet, and he had a lot of dinner parties on his ships, and then interested in gunnery practice, which is was scientific and mathematical. But then she says as far as charts and navigation, he knew nothing, cared nothing, and England fell way behind because of Henry's problem. So, no, I don't. I think that if Henry knew the New World was there, he just didn't care about it. He had his own troubles at home, and he wanted France. But that's about all the further he wanted to go away.
I'll just raise one question to Mr. McGinnis here, perhaps the last question. I was really surprised that there was no mention of an outpouring of pamphlets soon after the massacre at St. Bartholomew. I mean, did that not surprise you in your...
Yes, I did a chart in my dissertation on how many pamphlets appeared in each year during the Wars of Religion. And I found that the big numbers came only when England was directly involved. With 1562, I think there's 10 pamphlets, and for the next decade, there's virtually none. 1585, when the League was formed, the English get scared. A number of pamphlets begin to come out and continue for a decade. Obviously, the English knew about this, were very concerned. The diplomatic correspondence for the year or so after the Bartholomew massacres was filled with horror and disgust at all this. Interestingly enough, though, although they just ripped the Guises and Catherine de Medici, Charles the Ninth to shreds, they don't say, isn't this a French thing to do? They don't use this as an excuse to attack the French per se. One other indication of what a tremendously deep impression this the massacre made upon the English was the edition of Fox's Martyrology, which was published, I forget which year, it was published a few years after the massacre. He only devoted a couple of sentences to the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre and justified this by saying, this story is known by heart to everyone. There's no point in going into it anymore. It's appropriate. This on page 4,000 something of his work, which I found very significant.
Another quick question?
I was just wondering, in connection with this, to the extent that we're not focused on Henry's French attitudes there, the Italians begin to assume that, I mean, they start talking about Catherine de Medici and Italian politics, rather than...
I can't recall. I wasn't really looking for Italian mentions. I don't recall any, anyway. But it could have been.
Well, thank you very much for your...
persons about whom these papers will be are indeed Homeric. The one was highly orthodox, the other one was heretical. The one was very meek and gentle, the other one was very stormy. But there's one thing that I think we'll discover in common as these two persons treat them. They're going to hope those men at variance among themselves are going to be treated by two very friendly persons. And so I think it was Father Patrick Town was very, very good the first paper, the one on the 16th century writer Alfonso Rodriguez. Father Donnelly became a Jesuit in 1952 and went through the same course that I went through at our college out in Florissant and then here at St. Louis University. He went through the degrees of A.B., Licentiate in Philosophy, Master of Arts and History, and finally, he received his Ph.D. in History from the University of Wisconsin. He received that in 1971, where he worked under the direction of Professor Robert King, as did Professor Freeman. His previous scholarly research has dealt with the origins of Calvinist scholasticism, and on that he has written several articles and a book, Calvinism and Scholasticism in Vermilion's Doctrine of Man's Grace. That book will soon be published in Studies in Medieval and Reformation Thought. It's going to be published by Bill of Life. And so with that, we'll listen to what he has to say about this writer, Rodriguez.
Alfonso Rodriguez was born in Guadalupe, Luis in 1538 to middle class parents. At 19 years, the Jesuit division at Salamanca. With only 6 years, he was a master novice. Although shyness made him somewhat ineffective in dealing with the lady, he showed signal gifts in dealing with his religious brethren. Serving later as rector, professor of moral theology, and spiritual director at the Jesuit houses in Monterey, Valladolid, Montilla, Cordoba, and Sevilla. His fellow Jesuits elected him as their representative at the order's important fifth general congregation in 1593, which had to deal with schismatic tendencies among the Spanish Jesuits. In his latter years, particularly at Montilla from 1589 to 1595, he gave weekly exhortations to the Jesuit community. Many of these are still extant in manuscript, and some have recently been published. It is these exhortations, together with those of his friend Gil Gonzalez Dávila, that Rodriguez reworked in Cordoba and Sevilla from 1599 to 1609 into the great work on which his reputation rests. The first edition of The Practice of Perfection and the Christian Virtues appeared in Sevilla in 1609. Rodriguez lived just long enough to revise and see it through the press, the third edition of 1516. The Practice of Perfection has three parts, each containing eight treatises and is usually printed in three volumes. The arrangement of material is loose jointed and follows no strict systematic development. The first two parts deal with material pertinent to all Christians, while the shorter third part takes up considerations proper to members of religious orders, particularly to Jesuits. The work constitutes an encyclopedia of the spiritual life, with a strong emphasis on asceticism and practical application. On mysticism, there is practically nothing. On the doctrinal basis of spiritual theology, we see only summary treatment. During the 60 years of the history during the 16th century, the Society of Jesus produced hundreds of volumes of religious writings, prayers, sermons, catechisms, hagiography, theological treatises, and poetical tracts. But no Jesuit attempted a long systematic work in spiritual theology. During the opening years of the 17th century, the Jesuits produced at least seven major works of this kind, all bearing similar titles. Those written by Francisco Suarez, Alvarez de Paz, and Luis de la Fuente certainly came from authors of deeper spiritual insight, theological penetration, synthetic power, and greater reputation. All seven of these works enjoyed some success, but only Rodriguez's became a formative influence on Catholic spirituality right down to the Second Vatican Council. Its success was immediate, enormous, and rather puzzling. By 1626, there were seven Spanish printings, as well as translations into English, 1612, French, 1617, Italian, the same year, Latin, 1621, German, 1623, and Dutch, 1626. There have been 65 complete or partial editions in Spanish, nearly as many in Italian, and many more in French. In the 17th century alone, there were six separate translations into French, the last of which ran to 83 printings. In all, there have been over 300 editions in 23 languages, including seven Slavic tongues, Arabic, Tamil, Basque, and Vietnamese, just to mention some of the more exotic. The three volumes usually run between 1,500 and 2,000 pages, so that the whole work is only slightly shorter than the final edition of Calvin's Institute. It has clearly achieved more editions and more translations than the Institutes, or for that matter, than any comparably large work produced by the Protestant Reformation that I can recall. On this basis alone, it deserves the attention of historians. But the circumstances of its use greatly enhance its historical impact. Perhaps I may be allowed a personal reminiscence. I entered the Jesuit Commission in suburban St. Louis in 1952. For two years, our daily order included a half an hour of reading Rodriguez. In our meager free time, we were expected to outline the three volumes, and then the Master of Novices checked and corrected the outline In some columns of notes, Rodriguez was read to his sisters at breakfast as a matter of rule every day of their lives, the first chapter of Volume 1 beginning again as soon as the last chapter of Volume 3 was finished. Pius the 11th grouped Rodriguez with St. Ferdinand and St. Bonaventure as classical spiritual writers whose teachings were still relevant to Christian living in the 20th century. For 350 years, Rodriguez helped to shape the attitudes of millions of Catholic religious during their most impressionable years, and through their teaching and preaching, he has indirectly touched the lives of hundreds of millions. Nevertheless, there is not a single scholarly article in English on Rodriguez. The books on the Counter-Reformation by A.G. Dickens, Henri Damiot, Pierre Janel, Margaret O'Connell, and H. Fulbrook Evanet never mentioned yet. Only historians of spirituality have paid much attention to Rodriguez. His remarkable popularity within religious orders requires some explanation. Certainly his clear, simple style and warm bonhomie commended him to many. His recommendations are prudent and safe, not likely to lead the beginner and the spiritual life astray. Probably his eclectic approach to the theoretic basis of spirituality promoted his popularity among diverse religious orders compared to a more definite or narrow work. Certainly, this eclecticism insulated his work against changing tastes in theology and spirituality. A great deal of his quotations and anecdotes look back to the early Jesuits and reflect their outlook on the spiritual life. Yet, Rodriguez refers repeatedly with reverence to the deeds and sayings of all the founders and leaders of the various religious orders, Benedict, Bernard, Francis, and Dominic, and the rest. He never even alludes to the great controversy, Deo Zilius, which upset the Catholic Church, especially in Spain, during his lifetime, and poisoned the relations of Jesuits and Dominicans. He never mentions Melchior Cano or Domingo Bañez, the great contemporary Dominican theologians who criticized the Jesuits from different angles. Only strictly contemplative orders would have found his manual inadequate. As he intended, the laity also made use of the work, especially through abridgments published in 19th century France. Many treatises were published separately, for instance, several early English translations in the first half of the 17th century. Rodriguez's spirituality lacks sharp definition. It is more theocentric than Christocentric. As in late medieval piety, Christ is seen almost always as the suffering Savior rather than as the transcendent risen Lord of glory. Liturgy and the sacraments play only a minor role in his piety. His comments on how to attend Mass are likely to drive a modern liturgist into a frenzy. Primarily, the Christian serves God by private prayer, by cultivating virtue out of love for God, and by energetically serving his neighbor and aiding him to salvation. There is little of a religiously oriented and motivated social consciousness in any modern sense in Rodriguez. Every book reflects to some degree the era of its composition. Rodriguez's practice of perfection was written in Spain for the end of the Counter-Reformation era. It reflects its era in unobtrusive but significant ways, particularly in the sources of Rodriguez's teaching and the pattern of the citation. Many of the giants of Counter-Reformation spirituality, Loyola and St. Teresa of Avila, for example, are reticent or casual in referring to their sources. Not so Rodriguez. He has few original ideas, but he has read widely in Christian spiritual literature, and he tries it repeatedly, if not always accurately. Indeed, his work is more a catena of quotations and anecdotes tied together by ruminations and comments, rather than a systematic development of a personal view. A large personal commonplace book was the seed from which the practice of perfection grew. There are 906 quotations from the Bible, always in the Latin of the Vulgate in the early editions, reflecting the Tridentine decree on Scripture. Modern editions, both Spanish and translations, obscure this by translating the Scripture quotes. From the Old Testament, Rodriguez quotes the wisdom literature with surprising frequency, not because he finds any particularly congenial spirituality there, but because of his keen eye for telling aphorisms. Among the New Testament theologies and spirituality, Rodriguez is not conscious of any choice, but his affinities are Pauline, but Pauline in the same sense, the Loyola spirituality is Pauline. Activist intent as a sovereign. It is the second half of the Pauline epistle, the moral exhortatory, rather than the doctrinal opening chapters that shape Rodriguez's thought. He stands closer to the letters to Timothy and Titus than to the doctrinal sections of Romans and Galatians. As in so much of the religious literature of the period, the church fathers hold pride of place after the Bible. Predictably, Augustus leads all the rest with 271 citations, closely pressed by St. Bernard with 258. Augustine and Bernard are also the most cited authors in Calvin's Institutes, as in many of Luther's writings. In Rodriguez, these are followed by Gregory the Great, 171 times, and Jerome, 144. Among the Greek fathers, Basil the Great easily leads with 115. Most of the church fathers are quoted at least a few times. Rodriguez's range of reading among the medieval schoolmen seems far more limited, and he is interested in the great scholastics as spiritual writers rather than as systematic theologians. Hence, it is not surprising to find 95 references to St. Bonaventure against only 86 to Aquinas. Aquinas appears 33 times. Rodriguez cannot be associated with any particular scholastic school, although he almost never refers to any nominalist author except Jean Gerson. To the delight of contemporary readers and the dismay of a critical historian, Rodriguez has called out dozens and dozens of examples and stories from church history and the lives of the saints who exemplify and drive home his teaching. The selection is quite uncritical. Many of his miracle stories are improbable. Some are grotesque and absurd. Yet the stories are chosen with an eye to the spiritual point they exemplify, rather than to the element of marvel that they contain. Among older writers, he draws mainly on John Cash and John Cunicus. I have discovered no explicit references to Jacobus de Voragine's famed golden legend. Among 16th century church historians and hagiographers, he draws mainly on the Cologne Carthusian Venerand Surius, 35 times, the Belgian Benedictine Francois Blotius, 18 times. He seems never to have read Caesar Baronius. Among personal acquaintances, he cites Suarez, Jerome Nadal, and the Jesuit general Claudio Acquaviva a number of times. Strangely, Rodriguez seldom mentions canon law, and the references to ecumenical councils are surprisingly few, 2 to Florence, 11 to Trent. Generally, with regard to disciplinary decrees touching on the religious life, the handful of references to papal decrees looks almost exclusively to the papal approbation of the Society of Jesus and its constitution. Obviously, a warning to Catholic critics of the constitution, both within and without the Jesuits. In short, Rodriguez shows little explicit concern with the Church's doctrinal magisterium as such. On the other hand, Rodriguez's 124 references to the Jesuit constitutions are striking. Again and again, he cites the writings and deeds of the great Spanish Jesuits of the first generation, particularly Loyola, 71 times, Francis Xavier, 20, and Francis Borgia, 21. They were all as yet uncanonized, yet Rodriguez readily assimilates them to the ancient and medieval saints and monastic followers. He sees the Jesuits as the latest in a grand tradition. References to contemporary secular literature are non-existent. The classical letters, surprisingly few. 10 to Plutarch, 8 to Plato, 6 to Aristotle. The 13 references to Seneca partly explain Henri Bremont's characterization of Rodriguez as a Christian Seneca, but still a Seneca. This is a bit unfair. What attracted Rodriguez to Seneca were his moralizing aphorisms rather than his Stoic anthropology. Although Rodriguez's main concern is to exhort the Christians to earnest striving for God and the acquisition of virtue by showing them practical methods in prayer and good works. He also insists on the absolute primacy of grace in passages which would have warmed the heart of St. Augustine. The strong practical and aesthetical bent in Rodriguez have led some to see him as anti-mystical. Again, this is not quite accurate. Rodriguez writes for beginners, and he is anxious to warn them against trying to anticipate God's call and force their way into this self-annihilation, this immediate union, this depth of power. He associates himself with Jean Gerson's criticism of Ruysbrecht, to be sure. Yet elsewhere, he cites power and Ruysbrecht with favor. He is non-mystical rather than anti-mystical. Yet his reluctance to quote mystical authors is no great, since so much of the success of the Counter-Reformation in Spain depended on the harnessing of the spiritual energy of mysticism to forward the cause of the institutional church. Never once does Rodriguez cite Teresa of Avila, whose writings were readily available in print. Never does he refer to John of the Cross, whose manuscript writings already enjoyed great vogue in Spanish monasteries and convents. Aside from his fellow Jesuits, Rodriguez hardly alludes to the literature of the golden age of Spanish mysticism and religious writing. There is one reference to Luis de Granada. There are 39 citations to St. John of Avila, that good friend of the Jesuits, but his writings are not mystical in character. Not surprising, he never cites the English mystics, Richard Roll, Walter Hilton, Julianne of Norwich, the author of The Cause of the Unknown. There are four references to Tyler, two to Ruysbrecht, none at all to Suso and Eckhart. The many references to Catherine of Siena are largely autobiographical. This silence on matters mystical did Rodriguez's popularity no harm during the 18th and 19th century, when official Catholicism was wary of mysticism in the wake of the Quietist controversy. How does Rodriguez's sprawling work respond to the Protestant challenge, which called into question the religious life itself, the theology of grace which underlay it, and many particular Catholic doctrines and practices that Rodriguez recommends? He simply ignores this challenge. He never turns aside to defend Catholic doctrine and practice from Protestant criticism, nor does he much bother with attacking Protestantism. It no longer constituted a threat for it. There are no indications of defensiveness. Trent has spoken, Rome has spoken, causa finita est. Luther is the only Protestant reformer he mentions by name. There are three references to that infernal monster who preaches blasphemies and heresy. But Rodriguez demonstrates no knowledge of Protestant teaching. Indeed, he sees Luther merely as a foil to the Loyalist providential role in history. Just as God sent St. Augustine to answer Pelagius and Dominic and Francis to foil the Albigensians, so God has raised up Loyola and the Jesuits to counter Protestantism. Nevertheless, Rodriguez devotes only 2 pages out of 113 in his treatise on the end of the Society of Jesus to developing this anti-Protestant theme. Incidentally, these are the only pages in which he uses military metaphors and terms to describe the Jesuits. Indeed, aside from the vows of the religious life, those doctrines and practices and medieval Catholicism most repugnant to Protestants are hardly mentioned. Comments on the Master's sacrifice, the sacrament of confirmation, marriage, orders, and extremunction, indulgences, purgatory, the invocation of the saints, the Marian dogmas, the rosary, pilgrimages, shrines, relics, carpal celibacy, tradition, merits, the works of supererogation, and papal primacy and prerogatives, all these taken together would not fill 10 pages in Rodriguez's massive work. Neither does he refer to the Inquisition or the Index of Forbidden Books. Likewise, there are no references to witchcraft, astrology, or magic, all preoccupations of the age. He does not refer to the national religious problem of the conversos, except once, to criticize pride and pureness of blood. Another noteworthy absence is the failure to mention any Renaissance humanist. Granted that Erasmus was considered dangerous by the Spanish Inquisition, there were others, such as Juan Luis Vives, whose orthodoxy was less in question. Moreover, Rodriguez does cite with approval several authors: Francis Borgia, Juan of Avila, Howard, Luis de Granada, Areopagite, who worked with on the Spanish Index with the efforts of that great heresy hunter, Melchior Cano. In a short work, silences have little significance, but in a work at large as the practice of perfection, they are significant and indicate the parameters of the author's thought world. Rodriguez's book was clear, warm, serene, and safe. Above all, it was practical. This is the reason for its phenomenal popularity. His enemies are spiritual sloth and pride, not the Northern Reformers. To the old historiographical question about the Byzantine Church, Catholicia Reformation or Gaia Reformation, the evidence in Rodriguez falls almost fully on the side of Catholic Reformation. Theologically and temperamentally, Alonso Rodriguez stands in complete contrast with the embittered Aragonese doctor Michael Cervantes. There is scarcely an original idea in Rodriguez, much less a revolutionary one. Cervantes forms, but certainly 100, perhaps 1,000 people read Rodriguez for everyone who read Cervantes. Rodriguez's readers generally agreed with him. Many, perhaps most of those who read Cervantes, did believe a huge pleasure of being scandalized or to refute him. Perhaps historians put too much stress on newness and originality. Pedestrian writers such as Rodriguez usually reflect the temper of their time better than a maverick genius, and they deserve the attention of the historian. Thank you.
I was just wondering whether we could have some questions now on that paper, and then have Professor Friedman's paper, or just have both papers, and then have questions for either person afterwards. And I think both of them would prefer to have the two papers read and then general discussion. So we'll get all the questions. So our next paper then will be that Jerome Friedman of Kent State University, The Archangel Michael versus the Antichrist, the Cervantes drama of the Apocalypse. Professor Friedman received his Bachelor of Arts degree from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel. And that is a distinction, everything. He also received his Master of Arts and Doctor of Philosophy degree from the University of Wisconsin, where he worked on Cervantes under Professor Robert Kingdon. He is presently Assistant Professor of History at Kent State University and Director of Jewish Studies. He is co-author of a textbook, or I don't know about the textbook, a book on the crisis of Reformation, Confrontation and Conciliation. He has authored several articles on Cervantes and is currently completing a manuscript entitled Michael Cervantes, The Theology of Optimism. So,
despite the fact that only about 12 people in the 16th century were familiar with Cervantes, all of whom wants to kill them, I think this audience here is familiar with Cervantes, and so the first page of this can be dispensed with. We're all familiar that he was Spanish. He was born at the beginning of the 16th century. His date is not really known. He was 1609 or 1611. George Williams has said that he was the perfect effigy, the veritable effigy for both Protestant and Catholic alike, for all that was wrong in the Radical Reformation, which is probably true. He was a physician, a fortune teller, lived under assumed names, traveled from country to country. We don't know a great deal about his personal life. If we did, he'd probably shot and scandal. It seems that the worst thing in history has found to say about Cervantes is that he is somehow the founder of modern Unitarianism. I don't know if that's really true. This is subject to a great deal of debate. Seeing that no more really need be said about Cervantes, we can, I guess, go forward to the millennium. Now, thinking of millenarianism brings several diverse pictures to mind, and Cervantes was absolutely none of them. He was not a confidant claiming to be Christ, or a master of Congress possessing a written commission from the Virgin Mary to usher into a new order. Neither was Cervantes an ecstatic flagellant who lived in Christ's passion through self-mutilation and thereby assuming some divine power. Conversely, Cervantes was absolutely not a follower of the Brethren of the Free Spirit, who cleanse themselves from the sexual intercourse with as many people as possible. There is no evidence at all that Cervantes shared even a moment in Thomas Munzer, the drummer of Nicholas Hausen, or any other person who saw some measure of social and economic reorganization in the coming kingdom of the saints. Servetus was none, and for this reason, he has escaped the millenarian identification. At first glance, it would appear that the race of apocalyptic thought was really dominated by the figure of the Antichrist, and only secondarily concerned with the return of Christ and the kingdom of God. In Servetus' schema, Christ and Antichrist are rival forces, with the fulfillment of time bringing the victory of Christ over his adversary. In many locations, Judaism is made apparent, as when Servetus wrote, Satan was incarnated as a beast, descending from the abyss of the sea to become hope on earth, just as the word of God, descending from the sky, was made a man on earth, one Christ, the other Antichrist. Indeed, Servetus saw in the Antichrist a power, albeit destructive, as great as that of Christ himself. Above the term incarnated was used to refer to the Antichrist, though it was conventionally employed almost exclusively in reference to Christ. But this was not the only similarity between Christ and Antichrist. Servetus wrote, perchance you oppose us that even before the papacy, the spirit of the Antichrist came to be. We thus conclude, the spirit of the Antichrist commenced together with the beginning of the spirit of Christ, but occupied papal authority. Thus, just as goodness existed from all time, so too did the forces of evil. Though history is a series of encounters between the two, the first confrontation came in the Garden of Eden, where man, created after the image of Christ and possessing the divine breath of life, succumbed to the devil, represented by the form of a serpent. The result, the Vedas explained, is that God withdrew from us and the serpent entered, two great evils. Now, the purely religious consequences of original sin are spiritual death, human weakness. But in our context, equally important, perhaps more important, are the cosmic effects which resulted in Satan taking possession of God's creation. The Vedas wrote, having accepted authority over man, the demons accepted authority over that which was made for man's use, as in the case of animals, over whom authority was first given to man. The evil one extended itself to animals who were infected by the serpent and thus do us harm. The evil is especially present in the earth itself, the poisonous fruit. The pollution in animals, too, is from the demon's infection. So great was the earthly pollution of Satan that paradise itself was nothing but a nest of corruption. And yet, even this did not absorb the power of the serpent. The Vedas wrote, the heavenly bodies are ruined and filled with it, meaning people. For the heavenly bodies are polluted with the serpent. The stars, which are from the time of the creation of the universe, are now openly free of God, and harm and sin now flow from there. While Satan's efforts have been recorded in the Old Testament, it is only with Christ's assumption of flesh, and, of course, the demon's incarnation, that the latter increased his activity and assumed his role as Antichrist. As a consequence, the rivalry between good and evil was heightened. Surely there were many who served Satan, but Servetus identified the Gnostic teacher Simon Mason as the leading official expositor of the views of Antichrist. Despite the widespread acceptance of this ancient heresy, Servetus asserted that the forces of evil, and I quote, did not prevail until the spirit of the dragon itself settled into the pontifical seat. There, at that time, was the consummate apostasy. The Spanish radical was not certain when exactly the papacy became the seat of evil, but he speculated it was truly conspicuous in stability and reign from the time of Sylvester and Constantine. Of course, the Council of Nicaea is formulated without tradition. As in the case of Eden, where God withdrew from man in the face of evil, so here again, with the establishment of the power of the Antichrist as ruler of the temporal world and the Christian Church, Christ again left man and the world in the face of evil. The Vedas wrote, in time soon after the Ecumenical Council, Nicaea, the Son of God was taken from us, the Church left desolated, and all the abominations were decreed into the law. And so for the second time God yielded to evil, and all Christian history since Constantine is thus tainted and corrupted. The extent of this pollution extends follows that there must be a spiritual resurrection in the future. The parousia, in turn, depends upon ridding the world of the Antichrist, that force which twice forced the withdrawal of God. Now, in determining how long the reign of the Antichrist might be, surveyors follow the Orthodox tradition that the reign of the Antichrist will endure for 1260 years, adding, at the end of which time there will be a heavenly war. To determine the temporal date of this debacle, he added 325 years to represent the Council of Nicaea during the Roman Council. This computation led to the date 1585 as the time the reign of evil would end. In this cataclysmic battle of Armageddon, the true saints would come forward to battle with evil, for they had envisioned heaven and earth against the dragon and the Antichrist would be dislodged. Daniel said these fighters would be the most holy. Many times he warned that only the holy would remain after the final destruction. And in writing to an unsympathetic John Calvin, surveyed the stress that man must take a stand against evil. And he said, it is men who will fight there, exposing their souls to death and blood for a testimony to the truth. Despite the prevalence of chiliastic speculation throughout the later Middle Ages and the Reformation period, Servetus' main source was the books of Daniel, John, and Revelation, and not the writings of Jurisprudence or Marian thinkers. He accepted in Revelation such notions as the Antichrist coming from the abyss of the sea, identification of Rome as the locus of the evil force, the identification of the Antichrist as the keeper of the people. These traits of the themes are not very significant, however, in light of Servetus' general divergence from his other scriptural sources. Unlike the first epistle of John, the Antichrist is not merely one who denies Christ as the true Messiah. Neither does Servetus follow the traditions of Mark or Matthew, where the Antichrist is identified with false prophets. Similarly, though he shows familiarity with Paul's concept of the man of lawlessness, the son of perdition, who pretends he is divine and sets himself up in the temple, Servetus' ideas surpass such views. Rather than characterizing the Antichrist as a man, even a great magician, this being is the very incarnation of Satan, much as Christ was the incarnation of God. Indeed, in this regard, Servetus' views are actually closer to Nicene dualism, where two gods are locked in cosmic battle. Significantly, the Spanish radical was familiar with ancient Persian books. Now, Servetus was not to be outdone, however, and he required to get other Christian traditions too, in presenting an Antichrist of near eternal proportions, rather than a being who appeared directly before the time of trouble. And while Servetus attacked the Gnostic Simon Magus as the source of the Antichrist's teaching, in actuality, his own view concerning the origin of the Antichrist run parallel to Gnostic ideas of a world held captive by an evil god who must control the world through the redeeming only the fulfillment of time. Servetus also observed Orthodox orientations regarding the efficacy of Christ's passion. While the Son brought to redeem the salvation, and over and over again, Servetus asserted that man's only redemption from evil lay in Christ's celestial flesh, yet it is the fulfillment of time which brings the transcendence of evil
unlike his time, the predecessor, his system was not based upon three members of the Godhead, where there was past age of the Father, or present age of the Son, and future age of the Spirit, bridging the channel of time between Eden and Paradise. So Vedas built his system by reinterpreting the significance of God's presence within the world through an exposition of progressive divine self-expression that accounted for God's withdrawal from eventual victory over faith. The Vedas concluded that the pursuit of the millennium was not a human enterprise in the fullest extent, but a divine undertaking, originating not from Christ's death when he promised he would return, but from God's original withdrawal from Eden, and possibly even before that. The coming kingdom of the faith might conceivably involve a rearrangement of social economic conditions and faith, but more importantly, the future would bring a total divine presence in the universe without an equivalent evil force. How then did Cervantes see the divine end? The Spanish writer observed different names being used in reference to God in the Old Testament, with each expressing to man some aspect of the divine being. If these various names were analyzed, their meaning would contribute to understanding the different phases constituting human history since these appellations existed in progressive seasons. He wrote about the name El Shaddai, for instance. Well, God appeared to the patriarch and was known under the name El Shaddai. And from the meaning of these names in this passage, it is ascertained that more is conveyed to the name Jehovah. For Shaddai comes from the Hebrew verb show, which means desolation, as though he were a great desolator or able to lay all waste. Likewise, El means strong and powerful, when El Shaddai, as though he were a mighty desolator. And under this name, he was first manifested to Abraham. Tevedis found other names, such as Elohim, Jehovah, Adonai, Sabaoth, Ol, and each name granted a degree of knowledge about God, which established a progressive sense of revelation. Each term then also initiated something of a new phase in human understanding and history. As an example, Cervantes wrote the following concerning the change of knowledge from the time of Abraham to that of Moses, or from the time of El Shaddai to the time of Jehovah. He wrote, "Therefore, although I have appeared to them," meaning the patriarch, "under the name El Shaddai, and though they have realized that I have laid waste Sodom and Gomorrah, yet they have not known that I am omnipotent. They have not known me under the name Jehovah." In retrospect, it would appear that God manifested himself in varying degrees to different people at different times, or as the Vedas summed it up, God spoke differently to Noah, differently to Abimelech, differently to Job, differently to Nineveh, and yet differently to others. Now it follows that the Vedas' findings must be twofold, to account not only for God's activity within the world, but that of Satan as well, for both potentates play an equivalent role in human affairs. Thus, if God employed his name to describe his qualitative presence to man, so too did the evil one use his various names that he too might be adored and understood by man. The Vedas cited such epithets as Bel, Baal, Balthor, Asur, Dagon, Queen of the Heavens, Seraphim, Elohim, Moloch, and yet others, and spent several pages describing these names and Satan, which ancient men venerated as gods. Bel, for instance, signified confusion and was first used during the destruction of the Tower of Babel. Asur was the human fertility god. The greater evil, however, was associated with the name Moloch, to whom the young was sacrificed. And Cervantes pointed out how Satan, in his own curious and devious way, continued this practice through the institution of infant baptism. He wrote, "Infants are offered in baptism with a great wailing of the floor, just as they were offered to Moloch to the sound of trumpets." The Spaniards believed the continuity of rites and rituals from earlier times through to the present was not coincidental, and for this reason he went through great pains to show how the use of candles and images and other things were common to both ancient as well as contemporary forms of Satan worship. The conclusion for Cervantes was quite obvious. He wrote, "If you study all the gods of all the people, you will discover Rome in them all." Thus, both God and Satan have revealed themselves to man in various forms, and throughout the ages have been easily confused.
overall phase extending from before even to the very end of time. The first period began before creation, where no proper name or term for God in any sense is suitable. He wrote, "It is to be practiced that God is always incomprehensible and unimaginable, nor can we form the conception of God himself unless he adapts himself to us under some form which we are capable of perceiving. It is in this first age that God first himself at El Shaddai when in contact with Abraham and other names and dealing with other people. All these aliases taken together can give but a partial glimpse of his true being. This process is rationalized and systematized in the second stage. As the famous wrote, second, out of the meager good pleasure of his will, he determines to manifest himself to the world, and thus, at the time of the law, he is manifested to all people. As we have already seen, the message conveyed through the use of the appellation Jehovah at the time of the law, because God was of an omnipotent nature. The third age was the refinement of the second, the Vedas write, he manifested himself to the prophet through the oracle, but more